You're listening to the Cycling Podcast, brought to you by iWocker. Flexible loans built for small businesses. iwoca.co.uk.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore. I'm with Daniel Freeb.
Hello.
And last week I had Daniel's naked torso staring at me. Not this week, thankfully. It's got a bit cooler. The weather is not quite as nice, which is a blessing. But instead, I've got a very, well, Lionel, Bernie, is there, squeezed into a Zed. An old Zed top, which is very colourful, Lionel. But are you able to wear that and also talk?
A bit of a struggle, having to hold myself in into some 30-year-old Lycra, Richard. It's a Zed cycling jersey from, what, late 80s, early 90s. One of the most striking designs. I think in our live tour, I described it as the sort of thing that Rafa would have done at the outset. You know, it's very, very Rafa-esque, isn't it? A kind of cartoon Zed going against the grain of the monochrome designs that they brought back into fashion. But it's a modern classic, isn't it?
Not sure you qualify for Gen Z napalm. No. Not the second Gen Z, anyway, maybe the first one. Maybe.
But I should explain, I'm wearing it, Rich, because I'm doing stage 5 of the Tour de Home after we record this podcast. And also, it was a sort of mini homage to your episode for Friends of the Podcast, which we recorded earlier today, about the 1990 Tour de France, won by Greg LeMond, who didn't wear this jersey. But
I was going to say, yeah, he didn't wear it.
Well, he didn't because he was world champion, but his teammates did all wear it.
It's one of the most divisive jerseys, certainly, in cycling history. I could never make up my mind. I think it depended on the rider wearing it, whether I liked it or not.
Daniel, as the arbiter of all things tasteful and tasteless...
I'm pretty ambivalent about it. I was curious, actually. I looked this up a couple of weeks ago when the women's clothing or women's fashion brand Empolka announced their sponsorship of what was formerly Bigla Katusha. I was curious, actually, because it struck me that I've not seen a Zed shop on a French high street for not that many years, but a few years. My hunch was that they disappeared maybe 4 or 5 years ago from the high street, and I couldn't really find much information about what had happened to them online.
Funny you should mention Polka, though, Daniel, because in this month's Cycling Podcast Féminin, which was out now, we have an interview with Matthias Thomas, the man who has taken over Polka, and actually took over the ownership or sponsorship of the team that was Bigla Katusha, almost at the same time as his deal to take over Polka was going through. He was talking about and taking over the cycling team up to the end of 2024. So Orla Shinawy spoke to him, and we hear why he's taken over that team in the latest episode of the Cycling Podcast Féminin, and I found that very, very interesting indeed.
Well, just to let you know, Daniel, there's still a Zed eShop online.
Yeah, they seem to exist, yeah, online.
It's children's clothing, basically.
The logo has changed.
The logo has changed. It's no longer a big pink Zed in a... What is that?
It makes me think of Roadrunner. It makes me think of Roadrunner because it's like the Zed is sort of running away. There's a cloud of dust coming out behind it.
Well, now it just seems to be a rather less dramatic Zed in a... What's that? That's just a sideways square rectangle. Anyway,
it's a beautiful homage, Lionel, and I hope you can make it through the whole episode wearing that top. But as you say, we have spoken about... We're doing a series, My First Tour de France, 4 episodes. Episode 1 is out this week. That's with Francois Thomazeau. Episode 2 is My First Tour de France. Episode 3, I think, is Daniel's, and episode 4 is Lionel's. And these will be released over the next 3 weeks, because the Tour de France should be on at the moment. And they are for Friends of the Podcast. Do sign up at thecyclingpodcast.com if you haven't already. We'll hear a clip from episode 1 a bit later in the episode. But the Tour de France should be on. We should be in the south of France now. Well, how do you feel about that? We've been reconciled to it for quite a while that it wouldn't be happening. But there was a moment on Saturday when I realised that, you know, I should be in Nice.
A strange sort of notion to conjure with. There's a good piece in the L'Équipe's magazine at the weekend, which sort of traced the last few months since Paris-Nice, really, as we've spoken about a few times over the past few months. I was at Paris-Nice, and the last stage, of course, was cancelled of that race. But over the whole of the final few days at Paris-Nice, it became clear, or it started to dawn on everyone at the race and at home as well, that the cycling was going to be sort of interrupted for a while, and we didn't know when it was going to resume. But in this piece in L'Équipe at the weekend, the quotes from Christian Prudhomme about that weekend, and he talks about having booked a table, you know, a lovely bistro in Nice with some of the other top brass at ASO, and how he was very much looking forward to that. And all of a sudden on the Saturday, he found himself instead sort of sitting on the street eating a tuna sandwich that he bought from a convenience store. And he said that was the moment when it dawned that this was really serious.
You goodness know, when
he peeled back the plastic film on his tuna sandwich.
He should try covering the bloody thing. I mean, we're offering eating those things from the service stations, aren't we?
I mean, I think he has covered the thing, hasn't he? As a former journalist,
he has. But I think he was, you know, rather more VIP level than we. I don't think he was in the sort of role that required him to stop at the services for a fridge flavored cold sandwich.
Very much so. I'm not really missing the fare we typically get from what they call the L'Arche, and what the other ones. And not so fond memories of the service stations, all the service stations we visited over the years. But also in this piece, I mean, Prudhomme talked generally about the difficulties, obviously, of reorganising the tour or postponing it, and the reception he got from local officials, mayors, and, you know, regional sort of directors, how it's all come together, really. And yeah, I think we can imagine it's been quite a feat. You know, hotels have had to be rebooked, the towns themselves, you know, a lot of them wanted their specific spot for specific reasons. You know, now, for example, Bastille Day is a very coveted slot in the tour route, and the town, I forget which one it was, but which was supposed to host the stage on Bastille Day, is now got a stage sort of on a Tuesday when all the kids will be back at school, no one will be on their holiday, and that obviously has serious implications for the revenue and the kind of visibility, the platform the town will get on that particular day. So it does seem to have come together, and I think at the moment, what we're still almost 2 months out, everyone's feeling cautiously optimistic.
Well, there is a Tour de France of sorts kicking off this weekend. It's not as prestigious as our Giro, is it, Daniel? But a virtual Tour de France, six stages held over three weekends for both men and women, kicks off in virtual Nice this weekend, and then couple of sort of transitional stages on the weekend of July 11th and 12th, and then Mont Ventoux and the Champs-Élysées on the final weekend. And there's also an opportunity for regular cyclists, people like Richard and I, to ride in the virtual Étape du Tour.
Daniel
even.
As well. Daniel's been riding his bike a bit.
Paris, the thought, yeah.
And the provisional start list has got some pretty impressive names on it. Egan Bernal, Mariana Voss, Chris Froome among the riders announced so far. That will be worth keeping an eye on over the next few weeks.
Winner gets to lead Team Ineos at the Tour.
I look forward to Mariana Voss leading Team Ineos at the Tour then.
Sorry for the hospital pass, Napalm, but do we know much about the format? Do individual riders have to participate in all of the stages?
That is a very good question. I don't yet know. I haven't looked enough into that. It looks to me like it could be
Challenge Mallorca rules.
It could be Challenge Mallorca rules. Good rules, I think, for virtual indoor cycling. But there will be yellow, green and polka dot jersey and a white jersey and a best overall team prize as well. So they're trying to replicate the Tour de France virtually and give us something to watch over the next few weekends. But we'll just have to tune in on Saturday and see. It's 36.4 kilometre opening stage in Nice, hilly. So I guess that's the Col d'Aise type stage that's being replicated. Should point out, it's all being simulated on Zwift. This is on the Zwift platform, so we shall see how it pans out. But as I say, our Giro, we managed a full 3 weeks of racing. you know, just weekend days.
They're all struggling to keep up, aren't they, these imposters?
They are. Just another couple of bits of news about the Tour de France. As this year's tour sort of comes onto the horizon, it only really caught my attention that the final day of the Tour de France in Paris clashes with the elite men's time trial in the World Championships, which is a, well, it's a strange clash that you would have thought that the UCI would want to avoid the time trial World Championships being on the same day of the Tour de France, especially when, you know, presumably they could have moved it to the middle of the week. I mean, off usually they have the individual time trials a few days out from the road race, don't they? I don't really get why that scheduling has been decided. And just looking ahead to next year's Tour de France, there is a scheduling clash looming for next year's Tour de France, which of course is to start in Copenhagen in Denmark. Now, the contracted date for the start of the tour is July the 2nd, which would mean the tour finishing on July the 25th. But because the Olympics has been postponed by a year, that means that there's a big clash. The Olympics are going to get underway on July the 23rd, and it would basically make it impossible for the riders to do the road race, I think. So the Tour de France wants to move back a week. But the problem with that is that there is scheduled to be a football match in Copenhagen on the 28th of June, the same weekend as the proposed start of the tour. And that could be a knockout match between England and Sweden in Euro 2020. And pretty sure that, I mean, Copenhagen would, well, it wouldn't necessarily want that clash, would it? A European, big European football match and the Tour de France kicking off at the same time on the same weekend. So coronavirus crisis is causing some knock-on implications for the calendar deep into next year.
One other bit of news, Lionel. Slovenian time trial championships. I know that all eyes are on Slovenia at the moment. And, well, revenge for Tadej Pogacar in the time trial. Roglic, Primož Roglic was second in that. And a double for the Pogacar clan, if you like, because his girlfriend, Urška Žigart, was the winner of the women's time trial.
Bit of a shot across the bows from Pog there, wasn't it? Because
quite a short time trial, wasn't it?
Yeah, and a tough one as well, finishing uphill. But you would expect Roglic, particularly a Roglic who was in decent form. We saw that the previous week when he won the road race. You would expect him to beat Pog in a time trial, but not the case. Of course, Pog did finish the road race a week ago with that. We had a bit of a bloody knee, didn't he? And we suggested that might have hampered him slightly. But looking slightly ominous ahead of the Tour de France, I mean, it's been a long time. I think Bernardino was the first rider to win his first ever Tour de France, am I right in thinking? And it will be Pog's first Tour de France. But
you mean ominous in the sense that Pogacar is an absolute shoo-in to win the Tour now on the basis of winning the Slovenian time trial?
Sounds slightly fanciful, Richard.
Wow. Is there time for us to do a run of Pog 1, Rog 1 t-shirts in a sort of football score? And then just as they rack up wins against one another, we'll just change the score.
You're listening to the Cycling Podcast, brought to you by iWalker. Flexible loans built for small businesses. Join 50,000 customers taking on life's twists and turns and scaling new heights with iWalker. If you run a business, find out more at iWalker.co.uk. iWOCA.co.uk.
I'm Liv Denyer. I'm a product manager working on iWalker's new product, iWalker Pay. We help businesses offer payment terms to their customers without taking on credit risk. I'm organising a charity bike ride from London to Brighton, and we're raising money for the Stephen Lawrence Charitable Trust. The Stephen Lawrence Charitable Trust works with communities and young people from disadvantaged and underrepresented backgrounds, and it's named after Stephen Lawrence, who was a Black British teenager that was murdered in a racially motivated attack. But his murderers were only found guilty and brought to justice in 2012. And an independent review concluded that the original investigation had been affected by institutional racism. In the wake of the Black Lives Matter movement and the deaths of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, and many others, we wanted to support a cause like this. We're all really horrified by the police brutality we're seeing in the US. It's really important to remember that institutional racism like this exists in the UK too, and to work to change that. Lots of us at iWalker are participating, and iWalker's matching donations made by employees. So far we've raised £3,000, which is really exciting. We picked cycling because it's a sport that we love at iWalker, and a ride like this is a great way for us to come together and try and accomplish something as a community. We haven't organised a date for it just yet, but we're hoping to complete it before the end of the year, and once it's safe for a large group to cycle together, and we'll confirm numbers when we've got a date.
Thank you very much indeed to our headline sponsor, iWalker. Very grateful to them for their support. And it sounds like a great initiative. Liv from iWalker explained there that she is organising a London to Brighton bike ride to raise money for the Stephen Lawrence Charitable Trust. And there is no date yet for that, but it will be this year, just as soon as it's possible to put on an event like that. And I've asked her to keep us posted on when it is. If you run a small business, go to iWalker.co.uk. You'll find lots of information there about ways in which they can help you. We were speaking the last part about the Tour de France. We're missing it, obviously, but also looking ahead to it hopefully happening in a couple of months. But the term you used, Lionel, was cautious optimism, and I would say equal emphasis on both those words in that phrase. Well, a couple of days ago I spoke to Matt White, the lead sports director at Mitchelton Scott, mainly about his plans for the upcoming resumption of the season and how he is putting that jigsaw puzzle together. And that's very interesting to hear that. He did tell me as well, when we weren't recording, that there was a major announcement coming concerning the team. And since we spoke, that major announcement has been made public. We learned that Shane Bannon, who's been involved with the team right from the outset and was, I guess, part of with Jerry Ryan, Matt White and Shane Bannon, those were the three kind of linchpins in that team. Well, Shane Bannon has gone and he's been replaced as general manager by Brent Copeland, who's joined from Bahrain McLaren.
Yes, Rich, that took us by surprise a little bit, the announcement that Shane Bannon was out of the picture. As you say, he's been a real linchpin of the whole organisation since day one. And a crack had certainly appeared, has appeared over the last couple of weeks between Jerry Ryan and Shane Bannon. It seems as though Shane Bannon had negotiated an arrangement, an agreement with the Manuela Fundacion, and was pretty happy with what they were proposing as far as the future of the team was concerned. Jerry Ryan either got cold feet or, as we heard from a couple of people, wasn't really very involved in that whole process of negotiation. But of course, he still had the team's license. So now Bannon is out of the picture. In come Brent Copeland, who's been around cycling for a long time. He was a team manager at Lamprey for several years, and then in the last few years has been at Bahrain Merida, Bahrain McLaren, someone we know pretty well. South African, wasn't an elite rider himself, but has also had some experience in the MotoGP world, and he's a pretty calm customer, a pretty shrewd operator, we think, but someone who'll be very much more involved on the management side rather than the sort of sporting technical side. And Darek McQuaid, who's another name and another face, who people who work at bike races and know professional cycling will be familiar with. How much do you know about Darek, Rich?
Well, he was the man that brought the Giro d'Italia to Ireland, to Belfast and Dublin in 2014, wasn't he? And he was involved in the Richmond World Championships as well in the US. So he's a figure that's been around and, involved in mainly the organisation of races and the promotion of races over many, many years.
And part of the McQuaid family, the McQuaid dynasty, you might be, I always get slightly tangled up in the family tree. So what relation is Darek to Pat, the former UCI president?
Well, Daniel, I did have to check this. Andrew McQuaid, the rider manager, looks after a lot of riders, including Simon Yates, of course, is the son of Pat McQuaid, the former UCI president. Pat McQuaid is the oldest of 10 siblings, and his youngest brother is Dara McQuaid. But the gap between them is so big, they never actually lived in the same house. Gary, meanwhile, is the son of Kieran, who is the next oldest of the McQuaid clan behind Pat. Do you follow?
Well, a further pertinent link to the Mitchelton team and the Mitchelton situation at the moment. the Yates twins, this is where it gets very complicated, because the Yates twins are both managed by McQuaid's, but different McQuaid's. Andrew manages Simon, correct? And Gary, Adam. The Yates question, where the Yates brothers are going to end up, is pretty key, isn't it, to the future of the team? And, you know, over the last few weeks and months, it's common knowledge that the Mitchelton Scott riders have had to take fairly sizable pay cuts. And this is the time of year when, under normal circumstances, certainly big name riders would be negotiating and sorting out their futures. I don't know what you've heard, Rich. I've heard a few rumours. Simon to Trek, possibly. Adam to Ineos are the two with the most sort of substance that I've heard.
I mean, that's an interesting one, isn't it? Because if we think back to the start of their professional careers, it was rumoured that Simon was offered a contract by Team Sky and Adam wasn't. So it's kind of reversed, if that's the case. The move Simon to Trek makes Trek Segafredo, that makes perfect sense, it seems to me, for both rider and team. Adam Yates to Ineos seems to make a bit less sense. But, you know, if we look at the position those guys have been in, that team did, Mitchelton Scott did, introduce very drastic pay cuts when lockdown happened, you know, during the last few months, up to 70%. And so I would imagine riders in that position would have been looking for, you know, other opportunities quite early on. And there was a great deal of uncertainty around the team. Ironically, now there seems less uncertainty. Gerry Ryan, I mean, my takeaway from my conversation with Matt White when we were talking about the team was that Gerry Ryan is reawakened and re-energized and more determined than ever to keep a hold on the team that he really has bankrolled from the start. So the team is certainly around to the end of this year and next year, and Matt did hint that there would be other sort of positive news on the horizon, but clearly the potential loss of the Yates twins would be a major blow and would force quite a rethink.
Yeah, it'd be a big sort of dent in the identity of the team. The team's identity, obviously, it's Australian, but it's been very much built around those two riders and their GC ambitions over the past couple of years. But, you know, a further thing to consider, certainly with regard to Simon Yates, is that a couple of years ago, well, I think Trek was one of the teams that he was linked to the last time his contract was expiring, and there was a lot of talk about him moving in the middle of the sort of 2018 Giro d'Italia, that he was going to move at the end of that season. Of course, he was wearing the pink jersey, he was dominating that race. I'm not sure how accurate those rumours were, how advanced negotiations were with Trek. I think they were with other teams, and we certainly believe or have heard, Rich, that he ended up taking a sizable, well, not a pay cut, but he sacrificed quite a lot of money to stay at Mitchelton Scott. He did have offers from other teams that would have been more lucrative.
Apparently, $3.5 million was on the table from UAE, and he signed for less than $2 million to stay at Mitchelton Scott.
So you wouldn't think that he would want to make a big sacrifice again, would you? You know, if you look at where he is in his career, I mean, this will probably be, or there's a good chance this will be the most lucrative contract he will ever sign, and the next one.
Yeah, and you don't want to be, yeah, a team that seemed at least to be struggling to stay afloat, I think. So, you know, I'd say ironically, the future does look a bit brighter now for the team, but, you know, there is still that kind of uncertainty around it. I mean, when I asked Matt White about all this, he did say that there would be a time and a place soon to talk about everything that's gone on with the team. But as I said earlier, I was keen to find out just how he's putting together that puzzle of planning for the rest of the season.
Well, first of all, Matt, how confident are you that the calendar that has been announced is going to be fulfilled? I mean, presumably you're planning on that basis. Are you confident that all those races will happen?
Look, it was a very ambitious calendar put out by the UCI. I think I'm hoping we can get through the whole calendar. I think we're going to need a little bit of luck to get through the whole calendar. At the end of the day, we as individuals and teams, we don't control the actions of millions of people. As we stand at the moment, in, you know, just before the 1st of July, things are pretty good in Europe. Things have certainly changed, you know, from where I am in Spain. We're at one time in the middle of the pandemic first phase, there was 1,000 people dying a day. They're down, I think, their last I read this morning that they had 11 or 12 deaths last week. There's hardly any new cases, and the region of Asturias is the first region to declare itself COVID-free. So there's been no cases there for more than 14 days. Lockdown has worked, especially Spain was pretty harsh on the lockdown, but it definitely worked. The fact that that's going to affect us as a mobile international sport is people are coming from everywhere. There's different laws and restrictions in every country in Europe. Some are quite across the board and some are very, very different and are being handled different by different governments. So am I confident of getting through the whole season? Yes. Well, yes and no. Yes and no. I think it would be one hell of an achievement and a hell of a lot of luck if we got through every single race on this calendar.
But you're planning for that to be the case. I mean, how we spoke at the end of last year about how you plan the season and the spreadsheets and the jigsaw puzzle, hugely complicated jigsaw puzzle has to be put together. This must be that times three or four. I mean, the complications of having different groups of riders preparing for different races, but in this condensed season, how on earth, how difficult has that been?
I found it as an interesting challenge. The big difference is the calendar is so traditional, and the build-ups, you know, people aren't reinventing the wheel. The build-ups for certain races haven't changed that much over the last 15 years. People are racing less, doing more specific training. Sure, that's changed. But where the races are now, it's something that we've never experienced before. And it's, you know, hopefully it's the last time we go through this sort of an experience. Although I do think probably we're still going to be dealing with the virus at least in parts next year. No one's done it in October, Giro d'Italia. The summer, you know, Tour de France is always in summer. 1 month later, how's that going to affect the weather conditions? More wind, maybe less heat. Who knows? And the big change is, you know, traditionally people have had a certain amount of races and certain blocks going into these races, and now that's totally been thrown out the window. So they're the key factors that have sort of influenced where guys are going. And then just the fact that, you know, the Giro and the Worlds are overlapping. The gap is very, very small between the Tour and the Giro. Some races, there's no long race. Besides the three Grand Tours, the only race over 5 days is Tirreno Adriatico. So guys are going to be coming into the Tour de France very light on, and that affects people in different ways as well.
And the last time I spoke to you, I mean, you were talking about, you know, riders, some of them living on their own in apartments who hadn't had any kind of human contact for weeks on end, and they didn't know when or if racing would resume. That was a very difficult period. I know you as a team were trying to organise things, you know, races, virtual races and rides and so on, but regular get-togethers online. Now that there is a calendar, I mean, how has that changed the way that you've managed the riders, and do you detect a big change in them as well, in their mood and their kind of their attitude towards training and racing?
I think it is very, very different individual to individual. I think in general, my group of riders, in general, most of the guys handled the lockdown quite well. Everyone handled it in their own unique way, and that's to be expected because, you know, everyone's had different life experiences going into that. Some people were stuck with their family. Some people were stuck on their own. Some of people were stuck in places that they normally weren't. And everyone handles being alone in different ways. So I think in general, the guys handled it well. Some guys wanted to stay focused through that period. Some guys really just switched off, knowing really that, you know, we weren't returning to racing anytime soon. And the one thing I have noticed is I think a lot of the guys, some of them it's given a new lease on life or a new lease on the season. Cycling's sort of surviving on a knife's edge at the moment. And I think, you know, there's a lot of teams having to make pay cuts to survive this season. A lot of teams are still concerned about what could happen if the calendar does get reorganized or cancelled. And I think a lot of guys actually, you know, when you take something away from someone that's they're used to, I think that people don't appreciate that until it's been taken away. And I think the guys who are coming back do really appreciate being on the road. If you don't love training, if you don't love doing what you're doing in this sport, you're probably in the wrong business or you're not going to have such a long career. And I think the guys who being locked inside and being forced to go on a home trainer for 10 weeks, you know, some people didn't mind it and some people hated it. But they had to do it and they handled it in their own way. But out the other side, I think there's an appreciation for the life that these guys lead. And professional sport's not easy, but I think that some guys definitely look at their profession in a different light at the end of this, at the end of coming out of the pandemic or the lockdown period.
You're one of the teams that had, there were pay cuts, and that might have been a distraction, but has there been any light relief, any opportunities to do things a little bit differently and introduce different aspects to riders' training?
The big one is home trainers. And people say, well, that's not new. Yeah, well, it's not new, but in general, professionals weren't using them that often. Most of our guys have chosen a location in Europe to live because, and weather plays a big part in that. And people don't move usually to weather places where the weather's worse than where they came from. A lot of our guys, that's why our guys are living in Andorra, or they're living in Girona, or they're living in Northern Italy. Home trainers didn't play a big part in the training or the preparation in most of these guys. Okay, yeah, Matt Heyman did it because it used Swift because of injury. And I think because people were forced into it, I think a lot of people have actually seen the benefit of doing specific work on the home trainer. I know a couple of guys have actually come out of this lockdown period stronger because of the period of on the home trainer that they're forced to do. So that's one thing. As far as how we kept the team tight, how we kept the team focused, yeah, it has been a challenge with pay cuts, and I think, and that's across the board with our team. We've had riders and staff, but we have a pretty unique group of guys and girls, and at the end of the day, people are all dealing with their own issues or problems financially or mentally in their own different way, and we certainly haven't forced anything on people. All those races we've done online, you know, we asked volunteers for those. If we have to fill them, then we might ask someone if they can do it. The vast majority of those spots in all the online stuff and all the virtual stuff has been because guys want to race. Those races are not easy. They're different. And if you have to do those races and you don't really want to do it, well, you're gonna get your ass kicked. And a lot of these races have been live on television, and I know people from other teams have put a lot of effort into these races. We've got so many different groups inside a team. So obviously in my group with the sports directors and the coaches, we have regular contact. And then I've been in contact with all 28 riders multiple times throughout the lockdown, either on Zoom calls or phone calls or sending programs or all of the above. And, you know, there was a period there where we did leave them, everyone up to their own devices, because in the middle of, I suppose it was sometime in the middle of April there, where things were looking pretty grim across Europe, really. The amount of people dying and getting infected was probably like it is now in America. But we did let the guys, you know, they're all grown men. They're all responsible adults that eventually they know they'll be returning to competition. And I think forcing things on people is probably not the best outlook to get the most out of them in the long term. But now we are coming closer to competition, and the focus is getting a lot more narrow. And fingers crossed, we can kick off in 30 days' time with Vuelta Burgos.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thanks very much to Science in Sport for their support of the Cycling Podcast. As ever, it's very much appreciated. In fact, we're all getting little new bundles of Science and Sport goodies imminently. We'll report back on that next week, because it's a product that we're not allowed to talk about yet, but next week's podcast we will. So you can try it for your running, Daniel, and you can do it for your home tour de home
Lionel. yeah it's an excitingly rebranded version of the People's Grand Tour. I'm just riding every day that the Tour de France would have been on. No, the Tour de Home kicked off on Friday night, and I took Simon the photographer's course record on the sex shop time trial, which he really wasn't happy about.
You wore a skin suit for it as well, though, Lionel, I believe.
I mean,
I heard this rumor.
I think you need that from a second source, Richard.
Well, listen, back to Science and Sport. If you want 25% off all your Science and Sport products, go to scienceandsport.com, enter the code SISCP25 at scienceandsport.com.
I took 32 seconds off Simon's record, I should say, over 2.5 kilometres.
Hammering.
Amazing.
Hammering. It just shows what aerodynamics can do, doesn't it? Well, before the break there, we heard from Matt White, the lead sports director at Mitchelton Scott, who has been putting together his writer's programs for the revised calendar, but there was a real sense, I thought, of realism in his approach to this. Obviously, they've got to plan as if all the races are going to go ahead, but there are challenges ahead, and we've obviously got our fingers crossed and we're hoping for the best, etc., etc. But the teams and the sport are getting to grips with just how they're going to run the competitions safely. And, well, the UCI have put out some protocols, haven't they, Daniel, on the measures that are going to be in place to try and keep the racing and the riders and all the people at the races as safe as possible.
Yes, Rich. Last week, the UCI put out what, at first glance anyway, seems to be quite a rigorous document, which sort of grades the risk as to actually staging an event. And then if the event is deemed, well, if it's deemed that the event can go ahead, then there are other measures and precautions that will be taken. For example, immunological testing before the race of riders. If tests do show up an immunological response that suggesting that the riders have had the virus, then they might be given a certificate which will allow them to race until the end of the season without having further tests. But otherwise, riders are going to be tested regularly. The staff, all team staff at races, are going to be tested as well. There's going to be a COVID designated or a special COVID doctor, which is who's going to be part of the race organization, who is going to manage cases, suspected cases, and questionnaires to fill out at stage races in particular, which will hopefully enable the race to keep moving, even if, you know, the risk factor does go up, even if the situation in a particular country or territory, well, it will be evolving, but hopefully the race will still be able to carry on. And you know, our fear, I think, was that if races do start, that everything could sort of turn on a dime. There might be an outbreak somewhere in that country or close to the race, and that could shut down everything. It looks to me as though the UCI are trying to, well, they've tried to anticipate that particular danger, and they're doing everything they can to make sure that doesn't happen, within reason, obviously.
Yeah, the UCI protocol talks about a series of bubbles, doesn't it? A team bubble and a peloton bubble. And trying to, I guess, minimise crossing over of groups from outside of those two bubbles, so minimising contact from people who aren't directly working within the race. But comparing it to a stadium-based sport like football, it does seem like cycling has got a much tougher job on its hands, especially moving around on a stage race and moving from hotel to hotel, and just through the course of moving around and going from hotel to hotel, coming into contact with a lot more members of the public, or, you know, staff in hotels are members of the public, aren't they? You know, there'll be an increased number of contacts, I guess, for riders and people working on the race. And so that's why this sort of traffic light system and a COVID-19 questionnaire, where different symptoms have a points value, and anyone who, you know, goes above a certain points value would then be tested, presumably to try to head off the likelihood of you know, if somebody is going to be within those bubbles with COVID-19, that the best thing to do is to know about it as soon as possible, rather than sort of you know, be unaware and having the possibility of the virus getting into the peloton and then spreading throughout the peloton.
I mean, it was interesting to hear Matt talk about the situation in Spain, and the very sort of draconian steps that were taken there to try and, you know, bring the number of infections down when it was very high indeed a few months ago. And it has worked, and it's kind of worked throughout Europe pretty well. There are one or two exceptions to that, of course. I mean, it's still more of a problem in the UK, certainly, and we've got places in the UK going back into a form of lockdown. And you know, where there have been cases or small eruptions of cases, the key, it seems to me, has been to move very quickly and try and contain it. And I guess the fear is that you know, if a rider is infected with coronavirus, they could, well, through the contact they have in the peloton and the easy exchange of bodily fluids basically in the peloton, you know, they could have infected other people. That would be the concern. But there's not a lot they can do about that. I mean, they can mitigate against it, you know, when the race itself isn't happening and in the hotels and at the starts and the finishes and so on. But it's the peloton itself that is a danger. Then there are the fans too, and from what we understand, the finishes and starts will probably be very tightly controlled, but people will be able to, it sounds like people will be able to watch the race from the roadside.
I think the other slight concern, Rich, is one about transparency. This system, a lot of these procedures that have been put in place do rely on, well, good faith of doctors, whether it be the COVID doctor, the race doctor, which we sort of take as read, and the team doctors as well. You know, we should really have full faith in the doctors to report back if someone gives a positive test for COVID, or if they suspect that someone has COVID symptoms. But it does rely on that, doesn't it? And it relies as well on, in some cases, riders and individuals reporting their symptoms to doctors. And you know, we've talked a lot in the last few months about the sort of stakes, or what is at stake here financially. You can imagine a scenario, or the scenario in which the Tour de France stopped, potentially the whole of the rest of the season was in jeopardy. I mean, the implications of that would be absolutely enormous. And, you know, I just hope that everyone does feel comfortable and able to flag up any concerns they have. The worry of what damage it might cause wouldn't stop them doing that.
Well, the other great intrigue about the Tour de France, of course, is Team Ineos and Chris Froome, the four-time winner, and Egan Bernal, the defending champion. But last week it seemed, you know, there was a lot of speculation last week about Chris Froome making a mid-season transfer, going to Israel Startup Nation in time to ride the Tour de France for them. That seems to have dampened down a bit. I mean, my view is the same as last week, that it seems likely that Froome will leave Ineos at the end of the year. And I think that, you know, his selection for the Tour is probably still in the balance a little bit. Daniel, you've been spying on him on Strava, haven't you, Froome, to try and gauge his fitness? Because, of course, he's coming back from his terrible crash last year as well.
I mean, I spy on everyone on Strava, Richard, so Chris Froome shouldn't feel singled out here. And I haven't been doing it in a particularly forensic way. But he's been up at Isola 2000, hasn't he, in the Mercantour Alps, so the southern French Alps, doing some altitude training up there, doing a lot of big climbs. And not pulling up any trees yet, but we're a few weeks out from the Tour de France. Wouldn't expect him to be smashing records at this point, I don't think, anyway. But as far as the Tour is concerned, you know, there's been some talk about whether the other riders at Ineos would be comfortable, and the management would be comfortable with him riding the Tour in possibly a support role if they knew that he was leaving at the end of the season. I would suggest that in Froome's case, I mean, obviously, you know, we're not party to all the conversations that have taken place, and we're not party to how relations are at the moment between Froome and his camp and the team management. But I would suggest that there's obviously a huge amount of goodwill towards Froome that's built up over years. I mean, there's a legacy question. He's been huge for that team, and I think it would be a bit petty and churlish to deny him a place in the Tour, and deny him the sort of courtesy of just accepting him in the team after all he's done for them.
But it's a big call, isn't it, if you feel that he could be a negative influence in that team, especially when you're going there with the defending champion, who for most people, apart from you, Daniel, because Pogacar is the favourite for you, but for most people, Bernal will be the favourite.
Bookman is my favourite. Pog is second. Anyway.
It's a tough one. It's a tough one.
You're setting up a hipster's bookmaker, Daniel.
Well, bookman does actually mean bookman, so yeah.
Yeah. Let's try and go into Dave Brailsford's head, shall we, and the way that he thinks. And everything that you've said there, Daniel, makes perfect sense. But I don't think any of that will figure in the calculations that Dave Brailsford makes about selecting the team.
Would you be more comfortable if you were Dave Brailsford and Froome was coming in clearly not good enough to win the race, but good enough to replicate the role of a Kwiatkowski or as a mountain domestique? Or would you rather that he was going in possibly an understudy, but also maybe if things go well, good enough to challenge Bernal and Thomas?
Oh, that's a tough one. Probably.
Because the second scenario is the dangerous one as far as the atmosphere in the camp is concerned, isn't it?
The first scenario requires him to be fully committed to that role, not just physically capable of it. And I think that's the big question. We saw even in 2012, that we can discuss that all we like about the Froome and Wiggins affair at the 2012 tour, but there's no question that Froome felt there that he deserved a chance. And if he feels at this year's tour, if he's riding and if Bernal's in the team as well, if he feels that he deserves a chance, he will try and seize that opportunity.
And if you're Chris Froome and you're given a chance between, it's clear from your numbers that you're not going to be good enough to win the tour, Chris, but you can go in and you can be our second or third man, you can support Egan or Geraint to win the tour. Would you rather do that, or would you rather someone say to you, Chris, forget about the tour this year, but as a parting gift to the team, from the team, we'll let you lead and be the undisputed leader at the Vuelta or the Giro?
Don't think that's going to be acceptable. I think what Froome should have, if I was Chris Froome, here's what I would do, and it's easier said than done. I would be promising to go to the tour in support of Egan Bernal 100%, because you got to be in it to win it, and the sort of disruption uncertainty that will have been caused by all this speculation over the last few weeks, which hasn't come from nowhere, that could jeopardize his chances of going to the tour at all. And so what happens once you get to the tour is a whole other question. Anything can happen. If he just kept his head down and said, yeah, I'll be 100% committed to Bernal, whoever's the best at the time, I will ride in support of them, no question at all, you have my loyalty, I think then we wouldn't be having this discussion. And once you're there, anything can happen. On day one, Bernal can crash out of the tour. Yeah. Bernal is the defending champion favorite, but he's not somebody you would bet your house on to get through the thing, or anything can happen even between now and then. So
yeah, absolutely. I think, and again, the tour doesn't work on, we might think that they would look at numbers before the race and say, well, he can't win with those numbers, but I still don't think that with someone with Chris Froome's pedigree you could rule him out. And as you say, Rich, there could be a split on day two, going over some gnarly climbs out the back of Nice, and Froome's in it and just marking the move. Bernal loses 30 seconds. And then we've seen it so many times before, that once you've nudged in front on GC, and then if you're all finishing together in a group inheriting the yellow jersey, we know how the tour plays out. And I think you're absolutely right. It's about buy-in and commitment. And that was where Bradley Wiggins fell foul, wasn't it, in 2013, and was left out of the tour. And I think that in a way, it totally different characters, but in a way a similar scenario might play out. And if we know that Dave Brailsford would, somebody like Geraint Thomas, even with a sort of ambitions kind of hidden just behind the eyes, he will commit to a plan, and he won't kind of upset the apple cart. He wouldn't jeopardize the team's success in order to chase his own. And I think that's what it would come down to. And I think you're absolutely right, Rich. If Froome said, look, I will commit to whatever the plan is, and we will make that plan daily in the bus, as we always do, and in the team meeting, and I'll go with that. But then, when the race is on and there's decisions to be made, then it's kind of game on, isn't it? And that's how the tour pans out.
You're absolutely right, and you've just reminded me there, Lionel, on the eve of the Giro in 2013, which Bradley Wiggins was going to try and win, he gave a press conference up in Preston, and he said there that he would, his plan, his ambition was to go to the Giro, win that, and then go to the Tour and try and win that. And that caused absolute well, a lot of anger in the Froome camp. And really, that was the reason that Wiggins didn't go to the tour. It didn't really have anything to do with an injury or anything, although he did have an injury. But really, his fate was sealed with those comments at that press conference when he gave the impression that his ambition was to win the Giro and then go as leader, Team Sky leader at the tour. That was it, because Froome was the better bet at the time. So history repeats. But speaking of Egan Bernal, I've got his Strava page open here, and it automatically gives you a side-by-side comparison of me and him, which is interesting. Wow. Well, he's the last 4 weeks, he's been averaging 31 hours training a week, 998 kilometres a week. He's been doing some big rides and some big climbs. He's in Colombia, of course. He is renowned as a very hard trainer, Egan Bernal. And I caught up with his coach, Xabi Arteche of Team Ineos. He looks after Bernal, just to find out how he's been getting on.
Egan, I mean, how has he coped with this period? What kind of effect has it had on him?
It's been pretty much everyone. At the beginning was a shock when everything started. Was a big shock because not everyone was in this lockdown. Some riders had the opportunity to train outdoors, and especially him, he was in a lockdown in Colombia. So the first thing they start thinking is, "Poof, I cannot train at the same level that the other riders are training, and the season is, or the races are gonna come soon." Then when you start realizing about how big is the situation, and it's gonna take really long, and the season is going to start in a couple of months, and I think everyone had opportunity to calm down and try to think again and analyze a little bit the situation now, and I think he's been quite calm during this lockdown period, and obviously he's been training indoors, and like I said now, previously when he had another two crashes, he used to use the indoor trainer for his normal training, so he knew how to work, how to do the things, how is the feeling that doing a long session in the indoor trainer. So it's not been something new for him, so I think for him, yeah, I think he coped really well.
I mean, motivation doesn't seem to be a problem for him. He likes to ride his bike and he likes to ride big distances. But have you been, without, especially in the period when we didn't know when the racing was going to start, did you try and kind of hold him back a bit? Or did you keep him on a similar sort of training program to, you know, as if he was preparing for the Tour de France?
No, personally, my approach was to hold him back now, to stop, reset, start planning again. And when we knew what was coming, I started with a real plan. No, it was really hard to keep working hard when you don't know when you are going to start racing, and also because psychologically, as I said before, it was like a bit shock for them. So I think it was important to stop, to have a small period. No, just it was 4 or 5 days to rest and to start fresh again, mentally and physically, in this new season, no? Because at the end of the day, it's like a new season.
And what would be any other ambitions this season? I mean, it's such an unusual block of racing that we've got coming up. Where would we see Bernal competing? I guess the Dauphiné would be expected, but anything beyond that? I mean, is there a possibility that he would go on to the Vuelta or something?
We are not thinking in this moment what we are going to do after the tour, because obviously he is still 23 years old and he's been training hard the last years as well. So we cannot forget that he's really a young rider, and we have to take care of him as well and don't push too hard. We know that he's got the capability to do two Grand Tours in the same season. Probably this is not the best one to do it. We prefer to wait how he's going to finish the Tour de France, and then we can sit down again and plan the rest of the season. As I said, it's quite hard as well to see him doing two Grand Tours this year, probably next year. It's a long-term plan with him. It's not just that we have to try to use him in every race, because he's one of the guys we have seen the last 2 years with us that his performance in every single race, it's been really good. If he goes to races, he likes to go to to race and to win and to perform well. He's not going to go to the races just to chill out or to discover a race. If he goes somewhere, it's because he really wants to do the best or try to win. No, I'm not going to say that he's not going to do two Grand Tours this year, but it's quite hard to see, in my opinion, that this is going to be the first year that he's going to be two Grand Tours.
He sort of joked last year that he might try and win Paris-Roubaix one year. This could be the year to do it.
Yeah, probably. If he's not in the Vuelta and the Giro, is going to be really, really difficult. So with this calendar, we have pretty much with three programs all the time. Everyone needs to race something. So maybe we'll see him in the classics.
That was Zabi Arteche, the coach of Egan Bernal, obviously very, very bullish about Bernal and the training that he's been doing and his prospects for the Tour de France.
He's in Colombia. They're confident they're all going to get back to Europe for racing in time for the resumption.
There's a chartered flight organised, that's correct. On the 19th of July, isn't it, Daniel?
Correct.
That plane will be bringing the riders and their partners back over to Europe. They should be okay for that. But before we go, you mentioned right at the start, Lionel, that we've been doing our My First Tour de France series for friends of the podcast. If you would like to sign up as a friend of the podcast, go to thecyclingpodcast.com. We must start thanking friends at the end of episodes again. We've lost the habit of that, but we'll resume that next week, I promise. Yeah, episode one is now out. That's with Francois Thomazeau. He's reliving the 1967 tour, the day in particular that Tom Simpson died on Mont Ventoux, and the 1986 tour, the first one that he covered as a journalist. And then episode two is my first Tour de France. That's the first one I saw with my own eyes in 1990. Let's hear a little clip now from episode one with Francois Thomazeau.
The first kind of conscious memory I have of the tour is 1967. I was six at the time, and watching the tour was great. It was it's like for parents these days, you know, video games for kids. Like you put the kids in front of the tour, it lasts for hours, and they watch the tour, and you don't have to look after them. So that was my memories of the of July was, you know, watching the tour on TV.
Après-demain, jeudi 29 juin 1967, départ du 56e Tour de France, la plus célèbre course cycliste du monde. Elle fut inventée par Henri Desgranges en 1903. Cette mauvaise langue de Jules Renard disait d'Henri Desgranges, sa culture m'a vite paru exclusivement physique.
And when it was finished, you went down to the beach and back, and that was about all we did, you know, at the time. And the reason why I remember very vividly, you know, the day when Simpson died in 1967, is that all of a sudden, normally the tour on TV was just kind of a background to your life. You know, you were there playing, doing things, eating, and the tour was on TV or on the radio. And all of a sudden, I could tell something was happening because there was kind of a tone of gravity on, you know, the guy, you know, commenting on the TV, you know, didn't sound the same as usual. And my father looked intently at what was going on. And even my mother, who was not interested in cycling very much, even though she was a fan of René Vietto. But I mean, they were all watching like something very, you know, special was happening.
Respiration artificielle, masque à oxygène, les techniques de réanimation sont impuissantes. Simpson est toujours dans un état comateux, état qui nécessite une rapide évacuation sur le centre hospitalier d'Avignon. À 17h40, les médecins constataient le décès de Tom Simpson et refusaient le permis d'inhumer.
And I was at six, I think I was old enough to understand that death was something serious, you know. And but the tour had always been about fun, you know, about the summer, about enjoyment, about winners, it was always a kind of a celebration. And all of a sudden, you know, death, you know, became part of the show, and it struck me very vividly as a 6 year old kid.
So that was Francois Thomazeau remembering his first Tour de France. And like I say, if you'd like to listen to that whole series, we'll be releasing one a week during when the Tour de France would have been on, and an extra one in the final week, so four episodes in total. But that's all, I think, for this week. Anything else to add, chaps, before we go? What are we talking about next week?
Can I plug another podcast? It was one about buffalo or a bison. Did we ever establish whether buffaloes and bisons are the same thing?
I think
it's
they
about
are.
Buffaloes anyway. It's a story about I think the title is How a Bison Attack Ended a Love Affair, or a something like a budding love affair. Anyways, the Outside Magazine's podcast, and it was released a couple of weeks ago. It's a cracking yarn, and yeah, I thought there was a very, very tenuous, tangential link to our pod with the bison/buffalo reference, so yeah, I thought I'd recommend it to people.
Well, check that out after you've listened to the cycling podcast Feminar, released this week, Inside the Peloton with Mitch Docker, released this week, and all the other cycling podcast related spin-offs that we're producing. But in the meantime, thank you very much, Daniel.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Lionel.
Thanks, Richard.
Good luck with the Tour de Home.